Welcome to the audio portion of the How to Look at Art module of the Art Foundations course. Here is the argument you have been waiting for.
I think this painting is the biggest waste of money I've ever seen. I mean, it doesn't say anything. Could have been done by an idiot. Well, maybe not an idiot, but any dude with a straight edge and a ruler and a couple of cans of paint could have done it easy.
Not true, Don, not true. I know this painting seems simple, but really it isn't. It's about color and design, you see? With color field painting, you have to kind of let the colors wash over you like light. These colors really sing. See how they vibrate off one another?
Sing? Sing? Let me tell you.
Well, what I think is that for that amount of money, we could have helped street people or helped retrain all the thousands of people in this country who've been laid off so they could get jobs. To me, families being able to support themselves and eat properly is more important than buying stripes of color that sing to you, no matter how well they vibrate.
Yep.
Well, that's a commendable concern, Cindy, but it's beside the point, really. You see, the National Gallery has a budget, and that budget hasn't got anything to do with retraining people or unemployment. Those things would come under a different department entirely. So it's a matter of whether the gallery should have spent the money on this painting or some other.
That's right. And on that topic, my own feeling is that the curator of a gallery has to have the power to decide what's important. After all, they've spent years studying art and artists. They simply know more about art than the average person.
Well, it's true that if gallery purchases were left up to the average person, we wouldn't see much new art. Joe Public has always railed against change, fought against innovation. I mean, think of the Impressionists. People laughed at their paintings. They thought they were preposterous, sloppy, evidence of no-talent losers who called themselves artists, but who really didn't know a paintbrush from a... But I do tend to think we could have used the money more wisely.
Yeah, Byron, I agree. They could have bought Canadian art instead of American. There must be Canadian artists who painted this color field stuff.
There are quite a few, and Newman influenced their work to a great extent. That's the point.
But what is it meant to be? I mean, like, is it part of a rainbow that got lost, or is it a close-up of a Venetian blind, or what?
It isn't meant to be anything, Don. Think of it as having to do with flatness, with not being a window, and as having to do with color.
Okay, Andalee, if color field painting's so important, why didn't the gallery buy a painting by some Canadian who was influenced by this guy, this Newman? That'd be cheaper, I betcha, and use the rest to buy the work of artists who aren't quite so well known. Artists in small towns across Canada, for example, who are barely surviving.
Not a bad idea.
But don't you think it's important for a gallery to have work from every genre and every country? Surely that's what an art gallery's for.
Me? I can't see why anybody thinks color field painting is such a big deal. My cousin, the one who works at Maple Leaf Decorating, you know, he does stuff like this every day, and he doesn't get paid $1 million, let me tell you.
Yeah, and it's our money, our taxes. I, for one, would like to have a say about how my money's spent.
Well, it's a lot of money, yes, but a gallery's job is to make us think and, well, stretch a bit. Learn to accept new ideas.
Yes, but it's also important that Canada's National Gallery show Canada what Canadians have done. And if they spend all their acquisition budget on American work, there's none left.
Obviously, we all have quite different opinions on this.
Very different.
So, I guess we just have to agree to disagree on this one.
I'm going out and buy myself some paint and a couple of rollers.
And some art lessons.
Now, stop your tape. Section 1, Lesson B. Hello, I'm Anne Swanell. I wrote this Art Foundations course. As you listen to my voice, you'll be looking at pictures, so you should sit somewhere where the light's really good so you can see every detail. Check that out now. If you're having to strain to see, it's too dark. Perhaps you can either move the tape deck or fix up a light. Take some time to do that now before you listen to any more. Ready? Good. For this lesson and the other lessons in Section 1, you'll be looking at the first 6 pictures in the separate coil-bound book that came in your kit. Turn to the first picture in that book now, Picasso's 3 Musicians. Let's see what we can find out if we ask ourselves why the painter painted this picture. You might feel like answering, well, I guess he just wanted to. Yes, but why did he want to? Why did he paint this picture? Sometimes, if we can't come up with an answer, we have to push the question a bit further and say, why did he paint this picture in this way? In this case, with the musicians all sort of straight-sided and flat-looking. Aha! Now we phrase the question so that it leads us to search a little further to find some facts, and also the answer. The clue is in that phrase, straight-sided and flat-looking. Picasso painted this picture in 1921, you'll notice if you look at the date underneath it. Now, what was going on in art in 1921? This style of painting is called Cubism. The Cubists showed us that objects are viewed from more than one point of view, that as we walk in front of an object, looking at it all the time, the shape of that object changes. In this picture, then, Picasso is combining several points of view into one flat plane. Picasso painted this picture to show us what was, in 1921, a new way of looking. As I said, our own observation, our own careful looking, when we noticed that everything was flat and straight-sided, was a clue. And, of course, the date was a clue as well. Yes, sometimes, to answer these questions, we have to do a little research. That's, in fact, what some of the questions are designed to do, to help you to see when you need more information. In this case, you'd have to know about Cubism to answer the question. But the main clue was visual, there, in the work itself. It's important to remember that what you see, what you see, is worth noticing, worth paying attention to. Turn next to the picture of the angel talking to a woman. Why did Fra Angelico paint this picture? In order to answer this question, you'd have to take into account the fact that this is a fresco on the wall of a corridor in what used to be a monastery in northern Italy. A fresco, by the way, is a painting done directly into the plaster the wall is made of, so that the colors are sealed in. You'd also have to know the Bible story, which tells how an angel came to visit the Virgin Mary to explain that she was going to have a child, the child who would grow up to be Jesus. The monks who lived there certainly knew the story already. This fresco was not done to teach then, as so many religious paintings were, but to praise. This fresco was done, as they say, for the glory of God. Now turn to the third picture in your book, The Third Class Carriage by Daumier. Why did Daumier paint this? This is one of those times that the title can give us an important clue. This is not just any compartment in a train, it's a third-class compartment. Nowadays we only have 2, first and second class, but in Europe at the time this picture was painted there were 3. Third class is where the poor people traveled. As you can see, they're very crowded, there is no privacy, and no luxury. Daumier is showing us how tired and resigned the people look, how rough their ride, as opposed to the first-class carriage where seats would be padded and there would be white linen pillows to rest on. Notice how the people seem unaware of the painter's presence. They're not posing. As if he were an invisible camera, Daumier has captured their patient blank stares. Daumier painted this picture to show us how life really was for the poor of 1862. Now turn to the painting called Le Moulin de la Galette. A galette is a kind of pancake, by the way. The picture that shows people chatting at a table in a park with a couple dancing in the background. These people are not patient and resigned to their fate. These people are not staring blankly into the distance. They're relating to each other. They're alive and emotionally involved. They are enjoying the pretty dappled sunlight, and you can almost hear the music playing. Again, though, notice, as in the third-class carriage, we are right there in the scene. The people in the painting are not posing for us. This is a sort of slice of life. So, why did Renoir paint this picture? We can say he painted it to show us what life was like for working-class Parisians on a Sunday afternoon in summer, when the light and the music made them forget their everyday cares. If we know a little something about the Impressionists who were painting at this time, the 1870s and 80s, that is, we can say that Renoir painted this picture because he was fascinated, indeed obsessed, with the way light affected color and form. The Impressionists wanted to capture the particular light of a particular moment in time, a moment that can never occur in exactly the same way again. Renoir tells us that this moment is precious because the figures could never be in quite that same position, and the leaves could never be exactly that degree of greenness, and the sun could never fall through them precisely like this again. Still asking the question, why was this picture painted, let's look at number 4 in your book, The Persistence of Memory by Salvador Dalí. Why, we may well wonder, did the artist paint watches melting? If we look carefully at the painting style, we can say that it is painted in a very realistic, meticulous way. But the subject matter is, to say the least, a little odd, unexpected. The barren landscape drifts off into infinity. A strange, unlikely creature is asleep in the middle ground. One watch melts on a bare branch, one melts over the side of a table, one looks as if it's being devoured by ants, as if it were an organic thing. An impossible landscape, right? And yet it looks very possible the way Dalí has painted it so carefully and exactly and realistically. An art historian would say it's surrealistic. Surrealism means above or beyond realism. The artist painted this picture to surprise, maybe even to shock us, possibly even to amuse us. He makes us believe the unreal must be real because it's so true to life. This brings us to a new thought, the idea that sometimes artists paint pictures to show us what the world is like, and sometimes they paint pictures to show us what they themselves are like, what they're feeling or thinking or dreaming. Dalí painted this picture to show what the mind is like. Chagall's painting, called I in the Village, which you will look at later in Lesson 1B, is another example of painting what goes on in the mind's eye, or in a dream, rather than what's in the real world. Now have a look at the painting called 100 Cans by Andy Warhol. Why did the artist paint this, do you suppose? Why would any artist want to paint rows and rows of cans of soup that you could see on any supermarket shelf any day of the week, all exactly alike? Aha, that's probably it. He wanted to show us how repetitive the images we see really are. Where we used to have a pot of soup simmering on the back burner, a one-of-a-kind pot of leftover meat or vegetables we concocted ourselves, we now have hundreds, thousands, millions of cans of soup all exactly the same. The beef noodle soup you eat is exactly like the beef noodle soup I eat, which is exactly like the beef noodle soup they eat in Manitoba and Ontario and Quebec and Prince Edward Island and all over America. We can say then that Warhol painted this picture to make a statement about our consumer society. Turn off the tape now and return to Lesson 1B. Section 1, Lesson C. We are ready now to look at the same 6 pictures you looked at in Lesson 1B, except that this time we're going to consider whether the picture tells us anything about the culture in which it was produced. When we look at Picasso's 3 musicians, we should remember that this was a style of painting which had not been seen before. This was not the accepted, the usual. This was new. This was revolutionary. This painting, then, tells us about a society that values an individual artist's personal vision, that allows artists the freedom to express their own unique ideas. Look now at the 2nd picture, Fra Angelico's Annunciation. Does this fresco tell us anything about the culture in which it was created? If we read about Fra Angelico, we learn that he was a gentle and temperate man who lived chastely, removed from the cares of the world in a monastery in Florence, Italy. Many other monks lived there too, all of whom, like Fra Angelico, dedicated their lives to God. So this tells us about the culture of that time. The 1400s, check the date under the work, remember? It was a time of religious fervor as well as a time of artistic flowering. If you look at the painting itself, you'll see that both the figures are placed under beautifully proportioned arches, very classical in design. This fascination with proportion and perspective was an earmark of the Renaissance. Now turn to the third picture, Daumier's third-class carriage. We've already said some things about the culture of this period when we looked at Daumier's reason for painting it. The picture tells us that this was a society where the poor did not have a very happy lot in life, and yet they are riding the rails as opposed to traveling in a dusty, bumpy cart behind a horse or plodding along on foot. The painting tells us then about a society after the Industrial Revolution, when thousands moved from the country to the city to work in factories. Turn now to the fourth picture, Renoir's Le Moulin de la Galette. Does this picture tell us anything about the culture in which it was made? Well, we can see that the people seem happy, they are where they are, not wishing they were somewhere else, or remembering better times. These are not aristocrats, but they're not the down-and-out poor either. They're ordinary, working people having a good time. So the painting's about a culture that knew how to enjoy itself. It tells us that there was time for leisure, that life was not all work. The very fact that the artist has painted a scene of dappled sunlight, has captured a brief moment in time, tells us that this was a society in which one could snatch and appreciate momentary pleasures, rather than being obsessed with more serious, longer-lasting truths. What about the fifth picture? What can we learn about the culture in which Dalí painted The Persistence of Memory? You've learned already that you need to pay attention to titles and to dates. It's necessary at this point to think a little more about the role a title plays in a work of art. Sometimes there appears to be little connection between the title and the work, so that one is knocked off balance by it. A title can alter your perspective or upset your expectations. Sometimes it can clue you in that the painting is dealing with the absurd, the nonsensical, or with dream imagery. Here we see that Dalí was probably painting dream images, and by this I don't necessarily mean actual dreams. They could be daydreams or imaginings. The problem, of course, with dream images is that they're often very personal, and it is difficult to communicate personal dream imagery to a large audience because other people have no way of understanding the personal language. Anyway, the answer to our question is that Dalí's painting tells us of a culture which was very interested in the workings of the subconscious mind. The sixth picture, The Soup Cans, clearly tells us something about the culture in which it was made. This is a culture where things are mass-produced, a consumer culture. Warhol often used images of everyday consumer items in his work, Coca-Cola bottles, Brillo boxes, and later moved on to consumerizing people, stars like Marilyn Monroe and Elvis Presley, whose images he replicated and duplicated and lined up in rows like soup cans. Turn off the tape now and return to Lesson 1C. Section 1, Lesson D. Look at Picasso's three musicians again. Are they meant to represent life the way it really is? Are they realistic? No, they aren't. People don't really look like this, and Picasso certainly knew that. He could draw extraordinarily well, even as a child, so we can be certain he didn't make these musicians look flat because he couldn't do any better. No, Picasso was concerned almost entirely with expressing his ideas about color and form, about rhythm and perspective, and not about making his pictures look like nature. Now look at Fra Angelico's Annunciation again. Is this meant to represent reality? Aha, good question. Obviously, the figures are a little too large for the loggia they're in. If Mary stood up, her head would hit the ceiling. What Fra Angelico wanted to stress most of all was the religious content, and so he concentrated on simple composition while still making his setting a place his viewers could identify with. They lived in Florence, remember. They passed this building every day, or, if they were travelers, they passed it en route. The angel is elegantly painted, but perhaps a little in awe of Mary's upcoming position as the mother of Christ. Mary is sweet and shy. These were the psychological realities Fra Angelico was concerned with. We can say, then, that the picture is meant to be realistic in that it's meant to portray a real event in the prenatal life of Christ, but it's not realistic in that it isn't architecturally accurate. By the way, Fra Angelico may or may not have been aware of this inaccuracy, we don't know. Now, look at Daumier's third-class carriage. Is this meant to be realistic? Yes, definitely. Daumier meant to capture every nuance of expression, the exact posture, all the details, the picnic basket, these people can't afford to eat in the dining car, the baby's bald head, the tired child asleep, the man who'd like to be a gentleman but who clearly isn't in the back. Do you see how his hat brim is battered and bent? How about the next picture in your book, Moulin de la Galette? Those bits of dappled light seem to prove that, yes, Renoir was after realism here. Notice the dapples on the dark clothing in the lower right, on the woman dancing, do you see on her head there, and on the ground around the dancing couple. The fact that this painting does capture a particular moment in time makes it easier for us to believe in it, to imagine ourselves there as one of the revelers. What about Dalí's The Persistence of Memory? Is this meant to represent reality? Well, as we said earlier, it's extremely realistic in its treatment, but not in its subject matter, or all of its subject matter. The cliffs and the water seem realistic enough, but watches don't really melt. Ants don't eat watches. There are no creatures like the amorphous gray beast asleep there in the middle, are there? Even if watches did melt, they wouldn't look like this. Glass and metal wouldn't melt at the same temperature, for instance. This is clearly a watch of the mind, a symbolic watch, a watch that's meant to symbolize time. So no, Dalí's picture isn't meant to be realistic. Lastly, let's look at Warhol's soup cans. Yes, they're pretty realistic, aren't they? So realistic, they might be a photograph of the soup cans, wouldn't you say? So why didn't he simply photograph them? I think because he very much wanted to make the point that the image of the soup cans is to be regarded as art, as a made thing, as part of our culture, not as a snapshot showing how life is. Now look at a picture we haven't studied before. Find Frank Stella's Singerly Variation 4. It's in the separate coil-bound book of pictures, too. It's the bright-colored circle. Is this meant to represent reality? This painting doesn't represent anything, really. It is itself, isn't it? Pure design. Almost as if Stella had set himself a mathematical or geometrical problem to solve. Sometimes, you see, the questions don't seem to apply. But when they do, they can help us understand where we didn't before. Now turn off the tape and return to Lesson 1D. Section 1, Lesson E. Back we go for the last time to the first picture in the book, Picasso's Three Musicians, to ask the question, how do these paintings work in terms of design? This painting is like a piece of music. The shapes and colors make their own rhythm. Arms and legs are rectangles, heads and feet are rhomboids, and eyes, buttons, and openings in the instruments are circles. The Harlequin pattern pants are made up of triangles, and even the musical notes themselves are made up of rectangles and circles. We see how the musicians work together and how interwoven the notes are when we notice it's hard to sort out one body shape from another. Our eyes move around the composition, connecting up the whites, resting on the blues and browns, vibrating on the red and yellow triangular pattern, circling down and around, swinging up and across, darting in and darting out. These shapes work together in much the same way as music works. The melody and the rhythms are all interconnected, sometimes echoing, sometimes in opposition. So we can say that this picture works very well, then, in terms of design. In fact, this painting's really more design than representation. What about our friend Fra Angelico's fresco? How does that work in terms of design? At first, you might think the design component doesn't exist here, comparing it to the Picasso. But look at those arches. See how the curves repeat and echo one another? See how the circular halos behind the heads of the figures echo the half circles of the arches? And look carefully at the grass in the garden. That's pure design. See how the flowers and leaves are stylized and formalized? They look more like a woven tapestry than a painting, really, don't they? Now let's turn to the third-class carriage once more. How's this working in terms of design? The first thing I notice about this painting is its earthy colors. Even the blues are warm blues, blues with a lot of yellow in them rather than red. We think of earth, of flesh, of the hearth, of wood and wicker and woolen cloth when we look at these colors. The second thing I notice about this picture is the feeling of entrapment I get, as if I can't breathe properly. Design can often be employed to create mood, and we have a nice example of it here in this painting. Notice that there are only two small escapes from the browny color in the picture, the two windows. Do you see how the brown extends from the foreground right up to the top of the painting? I think it's very stuffy in that carriage. It probably smells a bit sweaty. Perhaps there's a strong onion soup or a meat pie in that basket, and maybe we get a whiff or two of that as well. Do you notice how the black-hatted man on the left is facing into the picture, so that our eyes travel from the hooded person with a basket to the woman in pink, to the silhouetted man, and back over to scan the crowd of people in the back rows of seats? That's design working for you, moving your eyes around the picture, making color and shape work to support the idea or the subject matter. Now let's look at Le Moulin de la Galette for the last time in this section. How would you say design is working here? Well, let's see. The green of the trees at the top of the picture is repeated at the bottom, and the darks are... Well, why don't you tell me how design is working in this picture? I've given you four examples now of how to do it. You take it from here. Remember to look at color and shape, and to try to see them separately from the subject matter of the painting. Try to see them for themselves, if you will. Remember to look at movement, at balance, and at rhythm. These are all things you learned in the drawing module. So if you want to review these ideas, that's where to look. And remember to talk in the present tense. Say, the colors swirl around, the reds bleed into the blue, he dances with her, and so on. Turn off the tape now and go back to Lesson 1E to do the assignment. Section 2, Lesson A. Take the post-it notes off the first six pictures in your coil-bound book, because now we're going to move along to some new ones. In the course book, you should mark these two. In Lesson 2A, Mount Lefroy by Lauren Harris and London Bridge by Durin. And in the separate coil-bound book, you should mark Turner's Salisbury Cathedral. Stop the tape if you need time to do that. Good. You're back again. Look at Harris's painting of Mount Lefroy on the first page of Lesson 2A. Light is the most important thing here because light is what shows up form. The mood of the painting, though, is probably closest to awe. The mountain is huge, taking up most of the painting. It towers over us, doesn't it, apparently breaking into the sky. Lauren Harris, by the way, was one of the first Canadian painters to explore, simplify, and distort his subject matter. You can see that this mountain is very simple. Harris has eliminated detail entirely, emphasizing only the main forms, the main planes. Harris painted the north shore of Lake Superior, the Arctic seas, and the Rocky Mountains, places where forms tend to be stark and dramatic anyway, and lend themselves readily to simplification and abstraction. In your separate picture book, find Turner's painting of Salisbury Cathedral. This, too, is a landscape, but it's a very different landscape from Lauren Harris's Mount Lefroy, isn't it? There are similarities, mind. Both feature a tall, conical shape that reaches up into the sky, but here the similarity ends. While the mood or feeling of Harris's mountain is awe, or some might say fear, the mood of Turner's is peaceful and calm. His is a predictable society. Order rules here, not the wilderness. Not fierce nature with her cruel rocks and freezing ice-sculpting winds, but common sense and predictable rhythms. These paintings use totally different styles. Which one looks most like a photograph? Most people would probably say Turner's Cathedral does, and so we can say his is a more realistic style. Harris sees the mountain as majestic and awesome, and that feeling comes across loud and clear. As I see it, he seems closely involved with it, whereas Turner seems to stand back and evaluate his church rationally, calmly. We might say that he finds the church a comfort, a source of inner peace, perhaps, whereas Harris sees the mountain as magnificent and perhaps frightening. Notice, by the way, that here we've been dealing largely with one of the questions you learned to ask in Section 1, is this work meant to represent reality? Next, I'd like you to look at the painting of London Bridge by Durin. It's in your course book in Lesson 2A. How realistic is this one? There's certainly no doubt about what it's meant to be, is there? But are bridges really royal blue and yellow and pink? Are buildings turquoise and red? Are barges pink and mauve? You may not have noticed at first that these things are weird colors. Artists call them arbitrary colors. By the 1990s, we've become fairly accustomed to looking at images colored like this, color film and television, infinitely adjustable, and color printing have made us understand that the color of everything can be manipulated. But in 1906, this painting was extremely shocking. The Thames was murky, the stone bridge was gray, and the buildings were black with coal. Everyone knew that. What sort of crazy person would paint them these colors? Derain and other painters, Matisse for one, was a fauvist. The word fauve means wild beast, which shows just what the public thought of them. You'll come across the fauvists again in the last section of this module. Turn off the tape now and return to Lesson 2A to do the assignment. Section 2, Lesson B. The pictures you'll be studying closely in the taped part of this lesson are all in your course book in Lesson 2B. Mark these with post-it notes now. Study each group of seven picture in turn, noticing the composition of each and paying particular attention to color and to brush strokes, remembering that these are reductions and so the brush strokes are much smaller than they would appear if you were looking at the originals. The painting by Varley on the last page of Lesson 2B is a slightly larger reproduction, so that you can see a bit better how rich and juicy the paint is and how confident the brush strokes are. It's important to remember that all of the group's work had brush strokes and thick paint like this. When we look at small reproductions of paintings in books, we often can't see brush strokes, and so it's easy to forget this fact. Turn off the tape for a minute or two while you look at each picture carefully. Hello again. The Group of Seven's work was exactly the kind of painting art critics found difficult to accept. They were used to seeing paintings where the lake would be done first, using smooth horizontal brushstrokes. After this, the trees would be painted. In Vardi's, you can see that some of the brushstrokes representing the water are diagonal or vertical. The lake here was painted after the trees were painted, in between the branches of the trees. Vardi has not painted a window on the world you can look through. He has regarded the surface of the painting as a surface, important in its own right. The paint itself is important here, its texture as well as its color, not just what the paint represents. Turn to the paintings by Tom Thompson in Lesson 2B. These paintings are very similar in that the artist has emphasized a single object in each work, in both cases a jackpine. Both works offer a view of Grand Lake in Algonquin Park and were begun when Thompson was a park ranger there in 1916. But these paintings are very different in mood. Think about these differences now and let's see if we can pinpoint them. Let's look at skies first. Do you see how the sky in the jackpine is painted with horizontal brushstrokes, while the sky in the west wind is painted with mostly diagonal brushstrokes? One is a calm evening sky just before sundown. The other's full of scudding clouds, full of movement and turmoil. Now let's look at the trees. Do you see how the branches of the tree in jackpine look delicate, decorative, poised like a dancer's arms, graceful like the tropon design in the lesson? The tree in west wind shows much more movement. We can almost feel the weight of the bough as the wind lifts it and pulls at it. Can you tell which direction the wind is coming from? The right-hand side of the picture or the left? Now let's look at the water. The water in jackpine is painted with straight, even, horizontal brushstrokes, like the sky above it, whereas the water in the west wind is choppy and churned up. All the waves have white caps. What about the colors in these two paintings? We can sense sunlight in the jackpine, can't we? Thompson shows us the sun is just setting by little glimmers of light along the branches, the waves and in the sky and on the water. In the jackpine, a warm golden light suffuses everything, whereas in the west wind, colors are much cooler and not so inviting and dreamlike. What's hard to believe is that when Thompson began painting, he did rather ordinary and not very accomplished scenes. Not until he was in his 30s, in the 3 years before his death, did he paint the powerful pieces that lit the path the Group of Seven would follow. Over the intervening years, millions have come to appreciate the Canadian wilderness through his radiant color and commanding brushwork. Tom Thompson died before the group was actually formed. Sadly, he was found drowned in Canoe Lake in Algonquin Park in 1917, just a year after he painted these two pictures. Turn back in your course book for a moment to Lesson 2B and look at the black and white reproduction of the painting of Mount Lefroy again, the one by Lauren Harris. Harris was a member of the group too. He was born into a wealthy family and was able to gain support for other painters in the group through his connections at many levels of society. He was the most intellectual and the most experimental of them all, until, at the end of his life, he was painting almost pure abstracts. You will learn more about abstract landscapes next time you listen to this tape. Turn off the tape now and return to Lesson 2B. Section 2, Lesson D. The pictures you will be looking at in the taped part of this lesson are all in the course book in Lesson 2D. Take a minute now to identify Frank Mayer's and Flemming Jorgensen's pictures. Remember, these paintings express the printer's response to the landscape. Notice the artist's name and the date in each case, as well as the shapes and colors. Take time to let the paintings work on you, rather than dismissing them with a quick glance. Turn off the tape while you do this. Good, you're back. Now, if you hadn't read the titles, how would you have been able to tell these are landscapes? What clues are there? Actually, there are a couple. In Frank Mears's painting, on the first page of Lesson 2D, for example, there is a horizon line. Did you see it? The blue shape at the very top of the picture is, in this case, a clue. In Flemming Jorgensen's painting, the white shapes on the green ground suggest buildings and grass. Or the light-colored shapes could be lights in the windows of buildings, which, because of the title, is probably the case. Or the artist could intend the light-colored shapes to represent both the forms of the buildings and the shapes of the lighted windows simultaneously. What do you think? But why should I have to go on clues, you may say? Isn't it better to make sure I know what the artist is painting rather than making it so I have to guess? Well, some people do think that. They like pictures to look as much like photos as possible. Other people, though, find that although they appreciate the technical ability of an artist who makes things look absolutely real, they get tired of looking at a totally representational picture. There's no mystery in it, they say. Nothing for me to discover and nothing for me to go back to. If I know exactly what that scene looks like, they say, I don't need to keep looking at it. Turn off the tape now and return to Lesson 2D to complete the assignment.